Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today on the show, I'm speaking with the co-owner and CEO of Elite World Group, Julia Hart. Fashion people probably are already familiar with Elite, but if you don't work in that industry, you definitely know the talent that this media conglomerate represents. Comprised of 48 global agencies, which represent 5,400 of the world's most dynamic talent, including actors, artists, musicians, models, and even virtual avatars, Julia's company is a global giant. As the CEO, Julia is also launching a tech-forward virtual marketing company, EWG Virtual, and is the creative director of E1972, a sizeless luxury brand introduced by Elite. More on that later. Most recently, on July 14th, Julia's life became the spotlight of a new non-scripted Netflix docuseries, My Unorthodox Life, which follows her professional life leading Elite and her personal life as a mother of four. But before she set out to revolutionize the talent industry, Julia was a member of an Orthodox Jewish community in New York, where her career and life looked quite different. She's here to tell us about how she made the extraordinary journey to where she is today, including leaving that community when she was 43 years old, founding her own shoe line, and becoming the creative director at Italian luxury brand La Perla all along the way. Now, on Second Life, it's Julia Hart. So, Julia, we like to take it way back to the beginning on this podcast. So, typically, I ask folks what they studied in school and what they wanted to be when they grew up, but I know that you lived and studied in an Orthodox Jewish community. So I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what that was like and how did it influence the aspirations you had for yourself growing up?
Wow, that's an amazing question. It would probably take 17 hours to answer it in total. So I will try to condense as much as possible. It's a very complex story. So I do actually have a book coming out that's going to be up for pre-sale in July. And believe it or not, when I first handed it in, it was over 1,700 pages.
Oh, my goodness.
So just to give you an idea, they've managed to cut it down to like a very manageable 450-odd pages. But that's the scope of the story. It took me 1,700 pages to write it.
Wow.
So to kind of summarize it, you know, my family is originally from Moscow, from Russia. They were traded for grain on the Varick Bill when Jews were just being arrested for being Jewish in the Soviet Union, in the USSR. And so my family was one of those families who had been victims of anti-Semitism, and we were literally traded for grain, and we came to the United States. The United States took us in and adopted us. And then my family, you know, switched one ism for another. And since communism had disillusioned them, they chose a very extreme fundamentalist version of Judaism to follow and believe in. Hmm. And in the world I grew up, the only thing a woman aspires to be, a young girl aspires to be, is a mother and a wife. That's it. You don't have any options for other aspirations. You're taught that your entire purpose is in the service of men. You know, disappear, be quiet, be silent, follow your husband's rule or your father's rule, and you're a good woman.
Wow. But you ended up graduating from school, right?
High school, yes. But first of all, you have to realize that there is a quote-unquote secular education, but it's taught by people who know absolutely nothing. For example, I, at 19, was teaching American history and mathematics to a high school class. Mm-hmm. So that says it all, right? It's not exactly qualified people teaching these subjects because basically they're just taught so that they can meet government guidelines, but they're people who don't actually know the subjects. So in biology, I learned the laws of gossiping. That was my biology class. So basically, high school is meant to educate women to make them good mothers and good wives.
Got it. Okay. So you were teaching, though, after high school. I'm curious about what sort of skills you were honing during this period of your life.
Oh, teaching taught me so many things because when I became a teacher, like I do everything else in my life, I'm all in. Right. So if I'm going to teach, I want to be the best teacher in the whole community, blah, blah, blah. So my idea was that, especially in the world I grew up in, when the only purpose of our entire existence was to be wives and mothers, it wasn't about making them memorize dates or names. It was about the story. Because in the end, that's all that would matter in their life would be the story.
Right.
Right. And in fact, in some of the schools that I taught, the girls weren't even allowed to study the Bible directly. They had to study something called Ein Yaakov, which is a man's translation of the Bible. And it's just the stories because, of course, women's minds are too stupid to be able to actually comprehend the word of God, right? So, yeah, exactly. So what I wanted to do is to inspire, because I thought what I was teaching was the truth. And so my idea was, I set a goal for myself as a teacher that if anyone would ever look at their watch, I was doing something wrong. I realized that teaching was like sales. I had to sell the material. Right?
I've never heard anyone put it that way before, but it's so true. Teaching is like sales.
Right? I mean, you have people who don't want to be there, who aren't interested in what you're peddling, and you've got to make them buy it.
Yeah.
So that's where I really honed what I call my skill set of sales, is trying to connect to people, looking at things from their point of view, from their perspective, so that what I want to share with them can be transformed and transmitted in a way that makes sense in their world and in their life. And so in all the years I taught, I only had someone look at their watch once. And
wow.
I still remember exactly the day. I remember the person. I remember what she was wearing because it was the only time I failed and I had someone look at their watch.
So obviously you are very dedicated. I'm curious about what you loved about teaching and what perhaps was not the best fit.
Well, what I love about teaching is very similar actually to what I love about what I'm doing. And that is, I think that most people, they want to be good and they want to do good and they want to make a difference and leave the world a little bit better than when they came into it. I think most of us want to live for something more than ourselves. And so to me, you know, dedicating yourself to a mission or a purpose that can help or inspire people, that feels like a life worth living. And so, you know, when I was in that world and I thought that was the truth and that was the way to be a good person and to be a useful member of society, I loved teaching because I loved sharing what I was passionate about. I loved what I thought was helping those women to appreciate their lives, to enjoy their existence, to understand the purpose and meaning behind the difficult things that they do. And here, what I'm trying to do is, you know, we've transformed ourselves into Talent as Media Company because the talent, our amazing models and actresses and sports people, they have the audience. They're the media.
Right.
And so what we've done is create the back office to kind of help them to transform their digital presences into brands and into networks, thereby giving them longevity in their career, because long past the time they can swing a tennis racket or walk a runway, they have an audience. They have a following. People listen to them and respect them. They are a brand. So it gives them longevity in their careers and financial control. They don't have to wait for someone to notice them or to choose them from a line. It's in their hands. And my job is to help them and to systematically and organizationally help as many women as I humanly can become financially independent and never have to ask permission from anyone. So the reality is that in a weird kind of way, the goal behind what I was doing was similar. It's just that what I thought was good and wonderful back then is clearly not what I think it is now.
Got it. Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit. So you were part of this community until your early 40s. How did your life and lifestyle change over that period of time, as well as the way in which you envisioned your life moving forward?
Well, as I had said, you don't really have aspirations. You're just supposed to be a wife and a mother.
Right.
And so as I got older and I started to my eyes kind of opened and I realized that there was a lot of things I was being told that was not true. Mm. And I started educating myself and reading. I mean, books saved my life in the sense that those were the only, you know, portals into the modern world.
Right.
I was watching Domina last night. I couldn't sleep. And, you know, they were saying a proper Roman woman needs to be a good wife, never contradict her husband, do what she's told, and have babies. That summed up my whole existence. Mm-hmm. That's the world I came from. It's like ancient Rome or the 1800s. You know, really, I'm a time traveler. I didn't move locations. I skipped a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
So, you know, as I got older and started educating myself, the more and more I read, the more I understood of what was outside of my world, the more unhappy I became, and the more that I couldn't keep it in anymore. So, of course, over the course of those years, I became progressively more and more miserable, you know, very unhappy with my existence. I contemplated suicide quite, you know, intently the year before I left. So it was not a good time.
Right. So let's talk about the year that you did decide to leave. In 2013, you left the community and made a massive change, which would also lead to your first career pivot as well. How did you set yourself up to be able to make such a major life and career and existence transition?
I mean, in a way, I had been preparing myself to leave since I was around 35, because mm-hmm. when I turned 35, that's when I gave myself permission to acknowledge that I wasn't happy. That's when I started educating myself and started reading books. But when I hit 43, a confluence of events occurred that was the impetus I needed to finally walk out the door. So it was Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. My daughter had just gotten married. And she had just moved to Israel, and that had been very difficult for me because seeing my 19-year-old child without a degree, getting married, I couldn't bear it. It killed me. Mm. So that had really, really hit me hard. And then, you know, we were told in synagogue that the reason Hurricane Sandy happened was because the women of our community were not being modest enough. And
oh.
So a whole New York State was punished, and of course, it was our fault. So that was delightful. And then the real thing that pushed me over was my daughter, Miriam, because she is so like me. Mm. She started asking the questions I've been having in my head my entire life when she was 5 years old.
Wow.
And so she wanted to bike ride. I mean, she won Spartan, you know, the race Spartan.
Yes.
She won Spartan, not for just her age group, for all women. Like, she's very athletic, and
wow.
She's extremely driven. And so she would say to my husband, why aren't I allowed to run? And he would say, oh, well, a man might see your knees. Your skirt might lift up when you're running, and so a man could see your knees. And she would say, but why isn't that his problem? And I thought to myself, yeah, why isn't that his problem? Wait a minute. Hold on a second. That is his problem. And that was a constant refrain mm-hmm. because she taught herself how to play guitar, but she's not allowed to sing. Why? Because a man can hear her voice and have inappropriate thoughts. No singing, no dancing, no soccer, no this, no that, right? It's a world of no. Your world is so small because you're not supposed to be seen.
Right.
The more you disappear, the better of a human you are. That's basically the message that women are taught. And she just wouldn't accept it. She would just keep saying, but it doesn't make sense. Hmm. So every day I get phone calls from the school. And then the last straw was when her teacher accused her of plagiarizing because what she wrote was so good. She said, oh, it must be from someone else. You couldn't have written this yourself.
Oh.
And she came home and she was so devastated and she could not stop crying. And she's like, I'm being punished for doing well. And I said to myself, you know what? Fuck it. I'm out. Literally picked up my shit, walked out the door with my daughter.
I mean, that's amazing. So tell me about those early days. You founded your own shoe company, which sounds incredible.
It's insane.
I mean, and also just like I'm marveling already in my head, but why shoes? And also, what had your connection to fashion been up until this point in your life?
The reality is that since I was a young person, I was obsessed with fashion, completely obsessed, which got me into trouble all the time.
Of course.
Because even though I was within the confines of the law, right? So everything has to be covered. The only parts of your body that are not covered are your hands and your face. Mm-hmm. That's it, right? Your hair has to be covered from your neck down all the way past your ankles has to be covered and your feet have to be covered. Even the walls of your house are not supposed to see your nakedness. So liking fashion was a big no-no because, number one, clothing was supposed to just be completely utilitarian.
Right.
To cover your body and make yourself look like a lump, right? You weren't supposed to attract attention. So looking good or feeling pretty, those aren't things.
Or showing your personality.
Or showing your personality by color or, you know, or feeling feminine or sensual. Mm-mm-mm. Those are not things either. So, you know, being interested in fashion is being too focused on the physical as opposed to being focused on your soul and the spiritual. So just a no-no all the way through. And me, I was always dressing in color, which was a, you know, a big problem in my community. But there was no law in the Bible, I looked, that said you can't wear color. And so when people would yell at me, I would say, show me where it says that I'm not allowed to wear color. The day that God makes the flowers all black and white, that's the day you can tell me to stop wearing color. I don't think God hates colors, and so I'm going to keep wearing that. So I was always getting in trouble. So yeah, this was kind of a constant refrain. You know, when you're 40 years old and you're still being called into the principal's office, that's problematic. So basically, you know, I was drawing, I was buying, you know, fashion magazines and hiding them in drawers I knew no one would see. And I taught myself how to sew when I was 19 years old. And I used to make patterns and create what I would call the tsniified version of whatever the outfit I was coveting was. And tznius is the Jewish word for modesty, right? So right. I would take those fashion and, you know, make them modest by making the neckline up above your collarbone and you need it past your elbows and past your knees and over your ankles, blah, blah, blah. But I was fascinated by fashion. It's something that no matter how many times I got yelled at for it, no matter how much trouble I got into, and believe me, constantly getting into trouble over the way I dressed, I just loved it. And to me, getting to choose what you put on your body is the ultimate form of freedom. And shoes particularly, because I am vertically challenged. I am 5 feet tall. So I'm very small and I love high heels. They make me feel strong and confident, but I hate being uncomfortable. So my idea was to create a shoe, the first ever comfortable high-heeled shoe, where you could meld the concept of luxury and beauty and at the same time be comfortable. That shouldn't have to be the choice of whether you have to be comfortable or feel fabulous. And honestly, it sounds crazy, like you leave your community and start a shoe brand, but you have to understand that the fact that I managed to leave, because it literally is time travel, I'm walking into a world I don't know anything about. Right. I've never been to a bar. I've never been on a date. I've never seen an invoice. I've never been to a club. I mean... You cannot fathom the culture shock. It's really like time travel. You know, right. There was a movie with Meg Ryan and I can't remember Hugh Jackman. And he travels through time.
Yes.
And lands in, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
That's what it's like. You walk into a world you don't understand at all. And so I figured, okay, if I can do that,
that's the
I can
hard
do
part.
Anything.
Yep.
And so I figured, okay, let's start a shoe company.
So being a first-time founder is massively challenging and full of new experiences for anyone, but I can only vaguely imagine what this period in your life was like. You've just entered this new society, as you said. Everything is brand new. These systems are new. Societal norms are new. You're pushing past them, forging a new path entirely in the founding of a brand that's your own. I mean, it's so remarkable. It honestly renders me speechless. So let's go to the practical, because this is the only way I'm going to be able to really wrap my head around it. What were the first things that you did to get this started and off the ground and funded and all of that?
Yeah. Well, honestly, again, it's almost a 500-page book. But basically, what I would say is I found investors. I literally met the guy who was my head of production sitting on an airplane. I mean, it's a string of like ridiculous miracles. It genuinely is.
Wow.
And you know, I made 1,000 mistakes. In the beginning, I didn't sign contracts. I didn't know. I'd never heard of a contract. I don't know what that was. Right? So I learned about lawyers and contracts and invoices. And so, you know, I just learned as I went and just became very adept at faking it until I figured it out. I convinced the factory to teach me how to make shoes. And I think I was so driven and so determined that people looked at my face and said, okay, she's not going to give up. We might as well just give her what she wants now. We're going to save ourselves some time. And that was pretty much how it happened.
It's weird to ask this because I'm like, everything must have seemed like a hurdle. But for you, what was the biggest hurdle that you felt like you were facing in those early days?
One of them, I think, is probably the only one that not most people can relate to. The first one is that I have no past, right? No history. Like, you think about it, you go to a new job, but you have your old job. You have the people that know you, you have a reputation. By the time you're in your 40s, you exist as a person.
Right.
I didn't exist as a person. I was nothing and no one. No one knew me. I had no relationships, no friends. I knew no one and I understood nothing. And so that loss of just years of relationship building and creating a reputation for yourself. Not having that has been an extremely difficult impediment that I've had to overcome because I'm a question mark, right?
Right.
And so people are suspicious about, well, where were you until you were 43? Well, you know, how do you answer that? So that was probably the most difficult part, is that I really was a newborn. And then the other thing is what I call my prisoner mentality. Mm-hmm. The fact that I still, and to this day, I catch myself much less frequently now, obviously, with this mindset that men know better.
Mm.
Men don't know better. Look at the state of the world right now. Sorry, they don't know better. But it had been so inculcated into my mind over and over and over again for the first 43 years of my life. So to eradicate that from my psyche, that has been very challenging. To listen to myself, to not give in and stay true to my inner voice.
Mm-hmm.
That was incredibly challenging because it's something I had to literally turn myself around and transform myself into someone who can speak for herself, knows her own mind, and does not follow directions.
Wow. Okay, so back to the shoes. What was that initial collection like? How was it received? And most importantly, how did you market it?
Oh boy, again, we need 30 hours, but I'll tell you my favorite part of this story, which is the marketing arm, right? So I'm a one-woman show at this point, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a silent investor here and there, and I've got a head of production who kind of quasi-works for me, and that's it. And of course, I know nothing about fashion. I don't know anyone. I have no PR. And I don't even know, like, how it works. Like, how do you sell things? Who do you sell to? I mean, this is literally how clueless I was. So I figured the only thing I know about fashion is that fashion is Paris, right?
Right.
So I Google most expensive hotel Paris, and it comes with the Georges Cinq, the yep. Four Seasons, the George V. So I book myself this giant suite there that's going to be my showroom. And that, I figure, you know what? We got to act successful to be successful.
Wow.
So I stayed in the most expensive hotel, picked this crazy beautiful room for the showroom. But now the big question is, how do I get people into the showroom?
Yes.
No one's ever heard of me. Okay. And because I literally knew nothing and no one, I didn't know exactly how to go about doing it. So I literally would sit downstairs in the George V with my shoes on, right? I'm my one woman PR show. So what I wear is what my company is.
Right.
Waiting for someone to literally notice me. Just watching fashionable people go by, like rocking my legs back and forth, but waiting for someone to notice my shoes. That was my genius idea. And what ended up happening was someone actually did notice me, invited me to a fashion party event. And I go to this fashion party and I'm walking around and this woman comes over to me, very elegant, well-dressed woman, and says, "I love your shoes. Where are they from?" And I said, "Oh, they're mine." And she says, "No, I understand you own them, but whose are they?" And so I said, "No, they're mine. They're my company. It's called Julia Hart. I just started it." And I launched into my whole spiel, beauty and comfort and all that stuff. Her name was Sue Martin, and she was the shoe buyer for Harrods.
Oh, goodness.
So the first person to walk into my showroom and make an order from my first collection of this one little woman show was Harrods.
Wow.
And once Harrods bought me, then everybody bought me.
I mean, that is so magnificent on so many levels. I'm in awe. I mean, what a fantastic story. Okay, so to skip ahead, because we have so much to cover. After about 3 years, in 2016, the Italian brand La Perla acquired your company. How did that come about? Did you waver at all about whether or not to sell or not sell? And what was that acquisition process like? I mean, that is just astonishing that that happened so quickly.
Well, we actually sold the lifetime use of my patents.
Got it.
That's what I sold because, you know, the whole comfort, what I call yes. Cloud9 technology, right? So that's what I sold. And it was exciting in the sense that to me, it wasn't about my name. It wasn't about it being called Julia Hart. The whole idea was about eradicating discomfort for women.
Right.
And La Perla gave me such a bigger medium and audience to do that. I made the first ever stretch Levers lace underwear. It was all about feeling beautiful, but also being comfortable, being able to move. And so to me, to have that opportunity to kind of take this concept of luxury and beauty, of having something that's utilitarian, but also having something that makes you feel beautiful and confident and comfortable, putting that all together, that's been my fashion goal from day one. So whether I did it through Julia Hart or La Perla, it made no difference. I just wanted to reach as many women as humanly possible.
So speaking of that too, so one thing that we've skipped in all of this is that you also became the creative director of La Perla, which is also just wild to me on so many levels and so admirable. So how did your responsibilities change in this role? And what perspective do you think that you were bringing to this really established, well-known brand?
So what I would say is that what Silvio Scalia, who is now my husband, had tried to do with La Perla prior to my getting there. So he owned the company for, I think, 5 years before I came. And I think there had been 5 previous creative directors.
Mm.
And what he had wanted from them and from me was to transform La Perla into a full fashion brand.
Mm.
And so when I took it over, what I realized is, well, why would someone want to buy a suit from La Perla if it costs the same as Dolce or
right.
Valentino or Chanel? Why should they spend $3,000 at La Perla that's not a name, right? if they spend the same $3,000 and get a suit, we have to differentiate ourselves somehow. Mm-hmm. And so my idea was to meld our expertise with that of ready-to-wear and create a ready-to-wear product that no other brand would be able to match. It needed to make sense that La Perla was making ready-to-wear. And so what I created was, you know, this whole innerwear is outerwear, right?
Yes.
I just took that and I blew it up. Basically, I created lingerie that could be worn outside, and I created the first ever suiting that had cup sizing. And if you think of anything that has stretch, right? You think of, like, let's say Hervé Léger. It's mm-hmm. traditionally very heavy.
Yes.
Because the more elastin you add, the heavier the garment becomes. And if you take a beautiful silk thread or you take a, you know, a lace and you wrap it in elastin, it feels terrible. It's like wrapping a silk pillow in aluminum foil, right? No good. So that's why traditionally most luxury brands don't have stretch, because once you add stretch, it ruins the feel and the lightness of the material. So what we did is we changed the way you add stretch. We put stretch inside the inner filament of the thread, thereby no more heft. It's not even an iota thicker, and you don't feel it because it's an inside instead of outside. So we created stretch chiffons, stretch laces, whisper soft things that were light as air and moved with you. So when you're wearing a lace thong, it's not stuck up your behind and torturing you as you're going through your day. Because that's criminal. So what I wanted to do is create this concept of beauty and comfort. And you should know that I got media training and I was told, Julia, the word comfort, kind of a dirty word in fashion world. You know, it's the whole suffering for beauty thing.
Mm.
And I'm looking at them and thinking, guys, it's 2016 and you're looking at me in the face and saying women should still suffer for beauty?
Hard pass.
Are you fucking crazy? Like, why? Who said? Because some guy decided that?
Mm.
How many shoe brands are owned by women? La Perla is a lingerie company, and other than the owner and myself, it's always been male creative directors.
Right.
Go figure. So it was fashion for women, but not for women.
Right.
I wanted people to be in ball gowns and feel like they were in pajamas. And that was kind of the idea of the ready-to-wear line, because that would distinguish us from everyone else.
Well, I think it's very chic, I'm just saying.
Thank you, darling.
Putting it out there. Speaking of chic, we have to talk about Kendall Jenner's Met Gala dress in 2017 that you designed. And I read that it was made of 85,000. 85,000
yes.
crystals mm-hmm. adhered yep. to a single string. Please.
That's correct.
Bring us behind the scenes of how that look came together. Had you ever seen your work have like such a crazy global moment like that? Because that was a reaction. Like the world took notice. I mean, it was jaw-dropping. It was so, so stunning.
Thank you. You know, I only had really one collection for La Perla and then I left. So that was my first moment that I got to show the world what my designs look like. And thank God people liked it. And Kendall looked magnificent. You know, the theme of the Met Gala was Rei Kawakubo. And so what I had taken from that was the fact that she used really unusual materials to make clothing. So I wanted to make a clothing that had no fabric. And so that was where the idea of the dress came about. So because, you know, her designs are much more creative in shape. They're not as figure forming as my designs were. So I wanted to stay true to my aesthetic,
right,
which is very sensual, very feminine, but still give, you know, tremendous respect and awe and admiration to her. And so I took the part of her that I could incorporate into my own natural style and decided to make a feminine, sensual dress, but made out of zero material.
I mean, what an impact. I mean, that was just like the dress seen round the world.
Oh, thank you.
So in 2019, you left La Perla and made another major career pivot when you took the helm of Elite World Group, which is, for anyone who doesn't know, a talent media conglomeration of 48 global agencies representing over 5,000 actors, musicians, athletes, celebrities, models, and more. So going from a creative director and designing to CEO is a massive shift in and of itself. And we're also talking about an enormous company. So, Julia, how did you know that this was the next move for you? And what was that transition like?
So, honestly, in the very beginning, I was quite hesitant to take this company on because when I first learned about it, in my mind, I thought models, scantily clad, standing in front of men who get to pick them. And I said, not for me. But then I realized that because of this digital transformation, because there has been this massive shift in the power dynamic and the talent now has the power, a woman today, instead of having to wait for some creative director or some casting agent or some photographer or some head of a magazine to like her look or choose her, which puts zero power in her hands, now a woman has all the power. Because if I can help them build themselves into a brand, that creates financial independence, longevity in their careers. They are in the driver's seat. They have the audience. Right. They're the media. And so when I understood that, it felt like everything in my life had come to this point. Because in the end, it's all about freedom. And financial independence to me means never having to ask permission.
So what's it like leading such a massive and global team? Like, what is the reality of your day-to-day at this point? What are the biggest challenges? What are the biggest learning curves? Like, what is it all like?
Well, it's very exciting right now, honestly. It really is. It's like the Wild West because, you know, creativity and organic authenticity is the new form of marketing and advertising that I think we can create here.
Right.
You know, watching something that was controlled by a coterie of fashion elite being open to the whole world, to people who would never have access to, you know, humanity. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have a talent and a dream and you're hungry, hey, if I could do it at 43, anyone can do it, you know? And so that's really exciting to me, the fact that if we do it properly, we can create an army, a global army of strong, independent women.
Right.
And I haven't left the design part behind. We started E1972, which will be the fashion arm of our company. It's the first ever sizeless brand.
Talk to me about that. What does that mean?
So basically, I hate this idea that there's size shaming or there's like a body norm. And, you know, I know so many people who are uncomfortable to go into stores because they don't want to say, can I see the size, you know, X.
Right.
And that's wrong. It's just wrong. And so my idea was, how do we do it where there's no size? It's just you. And that's your size. And that's perfect. And you're perfect as you are. And so what we're doing, of course, we launched it in February, literally 2 weeks before COVID hit. So we paused it. It seemed pretty impractical to start a brand during COVID. So we'll really relaunch it again next year. But the technology that we'll use, that we'll have up and running in the next months, is that basically you go on the app, you can scan your body, and it's made to measure. So that scan gives us the measurements. We create your garment and send it directly to your home. And it's your size. There is never going to be a size on it, ever.
It's just you.
It's just you. And that's what it should be. Even the words plus size makes me crazy. Who determined what's plus size? I'm sorry. It's your size, your way, end of story.
And it's also something, like, as a shopper, you're one size in one brand and another size in another brand. And that part can be frustrating and, you know, difficult, to put it mildly. So, I mean, the fact that this is really made for you is very appealing.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's really exciting. I just want women to feel good about themselves. That's all.
I mean, that seems to be a through line in your life.
Yeah, as you can tell, it's pretty much freedom and helping women is pretty much all I care about.
And financial autonomy. Those are the big things that matter, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And to me, that is freedom, right?
Yeah.
When you can't buy a ticket to visit a friend and you can't make a decision or own anything, you're not free.
Right. So I also want to talk about your new unscripted show, My Unorthodox Life, which premieres on Netflix in July. What has it been like filming this series? And was it what you expected?
First of all, I have to say, literally the best experience I've ever had.
Well, that is great. That's a good starting point.
Unbelievable. And I'm going to tell you why. It's really down to Netflix and Jeff Jenkins. And I promise you, they are not paying me to say this. But I have to put it out there because it's really blown me away. My entire team of the most extraordinary, brilliant, hardworking, dedicated, just fantastically collaborative, smart people, they're all women. Mm. When we get on a Zoom call, it's a team of women. It makes me so happy. Literally, I see their faces and it makes my day.
So what can people expect from the show? What do you hope people take away from this project?
Expect the unexpected, baby. You know, it basically follows my life, business and personal, and it is a bit of a crazy one. So, you know, hopefully people can kind of get to know me and see what it is that we're doing at Elite, why it matters so much. Because to me, what we're doing in our company right now, it is not a job. It is not a company. It's a mission. We are on a mission. And so I hope that people watching the show will get inspired. We'll make peace with people that, you know, they may have had difficulties with in the past. Or we'll take that step towards fulfilling whatever goal they had that they have been a bit nervous to reach out for. So, you know, I hope that the messages people take are positive and inspiring. And, you know, if I can impact some people's lives, that would be great.
So I also want to talk about something that we discuss on this podcast a fair amount is how our first life actually is a really formative time, even if we don't realize it, because we're learning things that then we end up applying to our careers later down the line and our second lives. So I'm wondering, if you look back and think about your first life, so to speak, what did you learn or what was particularly helpful and useful that you use today as a CEO, as a fashion designer, and as an entrepreneur?
I have taken a lot with me from my old world. Mm-hmm. I love being a Jewish woman. I learned incredible things in my world that stand me in good stead today. For example, in that community, gratitude, community, appreciation, kindness, charity, these are all precepts and concepts that are inculcated into you from the day that you're a baby. And those are things I have tried to take with me because I think being appreciative, not think that things are coming to you, working hard, thinking about others, being generous, these are important traits. These make the world a better place.
Right.
And, you know, we're going to be taking our company public soon, and I am gifting shares to every single person in my company so that we all will own Elite when we go public, so that we all share in the success and in the growth. And I think, you know, these are things, community and unity, these are things that I take from the world I grew up in. And I would say the other thing from the business perspective is that the whole idea of what's accepted wisdom or experts, I don't buy it. I just don't buy it. I spent an entire lifetime of men telling me they know better, that they're smarter, and that this is the way it is. My answer is, don't care what is. We're going to make what should be. And you don't have the answers, and you're not smarter. So, yeah, that's pretty much what I took away.
Those are good lessons. So one of the things we also like to talk about on this podcast is mistakes, because we all make them in our careers. And I think it's important to talk about the lessons that we learn from it, because I think you know, in the social media world, we all present everything as just a highlight reel. But the reality is we don't just go from win to win to win. So I'm wondering if you can tell me about a career mistake or misstep or something that happened and what you learned from it.
First of all, I have to tell you that I love mistakes. I genuinely love mistakes. I made a rule for myself that I keep to this day to do at least once a week something that scares me shitless. Because I think that not being afraid of making mistakes, being comfortable with being uncomfortable, is the greatest asset to success. Because if you're going to be afraid of making mistakes, then you're not going to do anything, because guess what? You're going to make mistakes. I made not a mistake or two mistakes or five mistakes. I made thousands of mistakes, tens of thousands of mistakes. But what I've learned from them is to appreciate them, to acknowledge them, own them, learn from them, and move on. Because if you feel uncomfortable with your mistakes, nothing's going to change. And you're just going to keep doing things the same way.
I like that. So a lot of the folks who listen to this podcast are in their first lives and they want to do something different in their careers, but something's holding them back. They're scared for some reason, or they just haven't been able to make that change. As someone who has made a number of pivots in her life and career, I'm wondering what advice you would give someone who is standing there ready to do it, but just hasn't mustered up the courage to make that leap.
So I'll tell you a story. So my kids, they wanted to go to a zoo, and I am against zoos because I don't like seeing anything in cages. So it just makes me very uncomfortable. But they begged and they begged. So I decided we could go to the San Diego Zoo. What they do is they kind of recreate these habitats, and you're in this little car and you go from habitat to habitat. So you're in this truck and we get to this place and it's some kind of African elk. And the tour guide says, this animal can jump higher than any other animal in the animal kingdom. So can you look around the enclosure and see where is the fence keeping these animals in? And we look around, we look to the left, we look to the right, up and down. No fence, no enclosure. We can't find it. We give up. And he tells us, he points out at the corners of the enclosure are four really long telephone poles. And the only thing attached to these telephone poles is a half pipe. So imagine, like, take a pipe, cut it in half, and connect it to four telephone poles. What happens is the elk, when it goes close to the edge of the enclosure, it looks up and it sees that telephone pole with the pipe, and that pipe makes it look as if there is a ceiling.
Oh.
So it looks up and thinks there's a ceiling and never tries to jump.
Wow.
It could literally walk out of its enclosure. It's all in their head. And that's my message. Women, you can do it. The ceiling is in your head. If you choose to take that step and you refuse to let anything stand in your way, you will succeed.
That is amazing. And also, as someone who grew up in San Diego, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Thank you.
Okay, so my last question is also my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with a younger Julia at any point in her career and give her a little advice, what would you say?
I would say, listen to yourself. That would be my biggest advice. Learn to listen to yourself. We are taught to be polite, to be appropriate, to be well-behaved. Even the adjectives that women and men use are different. Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
When a man is successful, you say he's a successful man. He's a powerful man. What do you say about a successful woman? Bad ass bitch. Great. Yep. Thank you. We got to change the adjectives.
Oh my God, it's so true.
And like, you think of the words well-mannered. Do you ever hear well-mannered man? No, it's well-mannered women. Right? Sorry, I don't want to be well-mannered anymore.
It's true. It's why I won't allow the word bossy in our house, because I say it's a gendered word. We never call men bossy.
Exactly. But it's so true. You think about it. It's all like we have to be man eaters. Mm-hmm. Like they can't imagine a woman who's successful, who's not Kill Bill, you know? I mean, guys, come on, wake up.
Oh my gosh, Julia, thank you so much for your time. This has been such a pleasure. You are truly inspiring and delightful. Wishing you all the success on the show. I am so excited for the world to see it.
Thank you so much.
That was the co-owner and CEO of Elite World Group, Julia Hart. For more inspiring interviews with women like Julia, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you're interested in hearing from on the show, so send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show's at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.